Good morning.
Good morning.
For years I was a pastor and I'd preach to others Sunday after Sunday. God loves you unconditionally. You were forgiven completely. And that you don't need the approval of others because you have the applause of heaven. And these are things that I believed, and these are things that I believe earnestly. And yet, my heart struggled to catch up with my mouth. What I want to talk to you about today is something that came up in our Q&A last time from a question Mill asked. So I just thought I'd continue that conversation of this gap. Most of us live with an awareness that there's a gap between what we profess to believe and what we experience. What we profess to believe and what we experience. In other words, you can know something, but that does not mean, in the Bible's words, that we have grasped. That's the Apostle Paul's word in Ephesians 3. He says, I pray that you might grasp how high and wide and deep is the love of God. So you can know it, but that doesn't mean you've grasped it in what he calls your inner being. My head says, my heart says, and my mentor likes to say the longest journey a man will ever take is the journey from his head to his heart. So that's what we're going to talk about today. You know a new phrase that has made its way certainly into your business and is making its way into our churches is emotional intelligence. That phrase was coined in 1990, but it's not a new idea. And of all the reasons followers of Jesus should care about this, besides the fact that once you have a good working definition of it, you'll see it modeled again and again on the pages of Scripture, one very practical reason stands out, that paying attention to and cultivating our emotional intelligence is integral to our addressing and closing this gap that we all live with. If you want to make this journey from your head to your heart, if you want to close the gap between what you profess and what you experience, if you want to grasp the love of God so that you are better equipped to love those around you with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, then developing what for most of us is a new skill, paying attention to our emotions, is essential. Now, I'm a bit of a contrarian. You know, if the crowd says go this way, I tend to just instinctively go that way. So you know one of the phrases that's been making its way around is from New York's own Pete Scazzaro, who's emphasized it's impossible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. And I've wanted to ask, now why is that? Is that true? Why is that? Could that be true? Well, the Bible calls us to grow up in every way into Christ to mature manhood. It's Ephesians 4. We can't do that without accessing our emotional life because knowing Christ is more than an idea. Knowing Christ is a relationship. The Bible doesn't just compare this relationship to a marriage. It says that our earthly marriages point to a greater, deeper, and more fundamental reality, and that is our union with Christ. That's the most important relationship in the universe, our union with Christ. Paul writes in one of his letters, "Do you not realize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is within you?" And I'd like to suggest that no, we do not realize this about ourselves. But we do know for any relationship to grow requires emotional presence. And if that's true for our relationships with people we love, wouldn't it also hold true for our relationship with Jesus? I mean, how can we be close to his heart while we remain detached from our own? And I'd like to suggest that many of us, especially as men, have been generationally. And part of growing up in Christ is the courage to admit, however professionally accomplished you may be, that we can remain emotionally stunted. So let's just have a conversation about this. What's your relationship with your emotions? There are two equal and opposite errors when it comes to our emotions. One error is to enthrone our emotions. If it feels right, do it. or if it feels right, it must be right. This fills the air of our cultural moment with disastrous consequences. Dallas Willard once wrote, "Feelings make excellent servants, but terrible masters." The opposite error, far more common among men in general, and especially men in the church, is to ignore, bottle up, suppress our emotional lives, maybe even as a sign of a strong faith. We were taught, I was taught from the earliest age, it was a sign of strength to deny my emotions. I grew up on the ball fields of South Louisiana, where I heard, "You're fine, put some dirt on it. Never let them see you cry." Phrases that my well-meaning coaches spoke over my life. But when I got older, it was hard for me to reconcile that with the real men of the Bible. David pouring out his heart before the Lord. The book of Hebrews says Jesus offered up loud cries and tears. I didn't do that much. We tend to numb our feelings and do something very different from what we see as strong, brave men of the Bible. Did you know that we are living in the midst of a revolution in our understanding of human emotion, every bit as much as the revolution Copernicus wrought many centuries ago? The upshot is how we feel affects how we think much more than we have ever realized. A big part of how I came to start the nonprofit that I now run, Broomtree, is the turn my life took because I was unaware of how much my emotions were affecting my leadership. And I lost a job that I loved and found myself in a place, boy, I never imagined I would be, unemployed and in therapy. Two things I never thought would characterize my life. You need to know I was well-intentioned. I was a hustler. Hard worker, determined to be a good leader. I simply was not aware how much fear, and in my case, anxiety, my need for approval, was still controlling my life. And here's the irony. If you'd asked me 10 years ago if I were emotionally intelligent, I sincerely believe that I was. I mean, I read the books. I read them. And I could give you a textbook definition. One of my heroes is a man named Parker Palmer, who once said, "We have this strange conceit in the West that just because we have thought or said something, that we understand it." Let me say that another way. You don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't know what I was talking about. And I was a pastor of a very large and successful church. Now, there were some signs that all was not well. Chief among those, a lack of contentment. I had every reason in the world to be the most grateful, content husband and father you have ever met. But man, I was a chronic worrier. If they gave an Olympic medal for worry, I would win it. You know, I've learned why a primary reason we worry is to avoid our feelings. You know, what can I do? Man, I can worry. An inability to be still. You know, in business circles, emotional intelligence gets a lot of airtime. Daniel Goleman popularized what neuroscientists have been learning. We tend to think we're quite rational in how we go about our lives, that the linear, logical left side of our brain is calling the shots. We assume in the brain's architecture that we work top down, that our conscious reason, our prefrontal cortex, is calling the shots, directing our lower subliminal levels, our limbic system. Turns out, our brains don't work that way. Kurt Thompson sums it up in terms of our brain's architecture. We now know through brain imaging that we tend to think bottom to top and right to left. That's his clever way of saying we're not nearly as rational as we think we are. And this is a rude awakening, especially for those of us like me who like to pride ourselves on being very logical in our thinking and who rely on our words like pastors. I mean, we like to tell ourselves that the left side of our brain is the master leading us, but more often it's our right side, our feelings, to overstate it a bit, that's directing our choices. And I'd like to tell you this new science turns out to be empirical confirmation of ancient biblical anthropology. To put it simply, you don't live out of your heads. You live out of your heart. And every decision you make is a decision of the heart. Thomas Cranmer, the architect of the Book of Common Prayer, captured the dynamic 500 years ago. He wrote, "What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies." That's the order. Our mind functions much more like a press secretary, Jonathan Haidt put it. It's a press secretary defending the agenda of the chief executive, the one who's really in charge. That's the heart. So, what is emotional intelligence? Let me give you a definition. This is from the book Emotional Intelligence 2.0. Emotional intelligence is your ability to recognize and understand emotions in yourself and others, and your ability to use this awareness to manage your behavior and relationships. Your ability to recognize and understand emotions in yourself and others, and your ability to use this awareness to manage your behavior and relationships. And you can see from that definition that emotional intelligence has two parts, self and others, sometimes called EQ self and EQ others. And let me say this clearly, there is no connection between IQ and EQ. If anything, they can be inversely related, as I might be Exhibit A. We start thinking just because we're competent in certain areas of life that our culture rewards financially, that we are competent in all areas of life. See our culture's obsession with consulting celebrities or billionaires on matters of global importance. Some of our EQ is genetic. Jonathan Haidt calls this the neocortex lottery. Our EQ is heavily influenced by the home in which we grew up and our earliest relationships. If you grew up in a home that nurtured and coached and validated your feelings, you will move out into the world with a higher than average EQ. But if you grew up with probably well-intentioned parents who for good reason trained you to deny or tamp down your feelings, and if you learn from an earliest age to construct an idealized image for others to compensate for the emotional neglect that you felt as a young boy when you didn't experience the safety and security, love, acceptance, and belonging that your heart craved, then most likely you entered adult life and have been living with serious EQ developmental deficits. And let me tell you, this is generational. Some of you have children. Here's the good news. No matter where you start, your EQ can change. For the first time in history, we can now observe empirically that we can, what the Bible calls, be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Neuroscientists call this neuroplasticity, which means the patterns, the deeply ingrained patterns of our thinking can be rewired. The key word there is deeply ingrained. What took decades to form is not going to be unwound overnight or with a good sermon or a good book. A handy way to think about EQ has two parts, EQ self and EQ others, and each of those parts in turn has two parts. EQ self has two parts, EQ others has two parts. If you invite me back, we'll talk about EQ others, okay? This morning, we're just going to talk about EQ self real quick. EQ self. Self-awareness and self-management. Self-awareness and self-management. So let's talk about it. How aware of your emotions are you? I've never met a man, especially a leader, who doesn't think he's self-aware. I mean, everyone thinks they're self-aware. It's like that old statistic that 87% of Americans think that they are above average drivers. Here's the paradox. One of the most reliable measures of your self-awareness is your awareness of how self-deceived you tend to be. Adam Grant wrote a great book about this I commend to you called Think Again. The thesis is the most self-deceived and biased person is the person who is convinced that he is objective and not biased. He says that is the hallmark of self-deception. The Bible puts it, never be wise in your own sight. As pertains to EQ, self-awareness means being present to yourself and knowing what you're feeling in the present moment. Self-awareness is your ability to accurately perceive your emotions in the moment, and understand your tendencies across situations. Your tendencies across situations means you're becoming more aware of what's been called our patterns and our scripts. Your patterns are your ingrained tendencies. This is the ruts that you fall into without even consciously thinking about it. It's what the recovery community calls our stinking thinking. Or you could just call it autopilot. Most of us just call it our personality. Scripts are the stories you've been telling yourself from before you can remember. Scripts, these are the core lies that you live by. A writer I like, Alain de Botton, says that we all tend to be crazy, and if we were more self-aware, our first question upon meeting would be, and just how are you crazy? Self-aware people know that we can all be crazy, because we're all subject to patterns and scripts. To become self-aware is to be able to detect in the moment, that you are reacting in your old habitual ways. And it's that new awareness of that millisecond between the stimulus and the response, and realizing for the first time in your life that you have a choice. You have agency. And if this is not the most exciting thing you've ever heard in your life, this is a good sign that your EQ self is low. You cannot become self-aware without developing your emotional agility. It's from Dr. Susan David. Emotional agility is the ability to be fully present because you're in touch with how you're feeling in the present moment. Okay, you can name it with some degree of granularity. Arthur Brooks, a Harvard social scientist, defines emotions like this. Your emotions are signals to your conscious brain that something is going on that requires your attention and action. That's all they are. Your conscious brain, if you choose to use it, gets to decide how you will respond. This doesn't mean that you never again, as a man, have to deal with anger, sadness, and fear, but that's just the point. You now can deal with them in constructive ways, in keeping with your deepest values. Becoming aware of your emotions doesn't mean you avoid your negative feelings. That's one of the key insights. The feelings are like tides of the ocean. They come and they go. There's nothing wrong with your feelings. They're telling you something important. Pay attention to them. They are data. But don't get carried away by them. They're not directives. Dan Siegel, in a famous book written for parenting, that's I think one of the best books you can read on this, called Whole Brain Child, he famously put it, name them to tame them. To measure your EQ, how adept are you at naming your emotions with any degree of granularity. And don't beat yourself up, because most men, their emotional vocabulary is three words: mad, sad, glad. Okay, of the 78 plus words at our disposal. Dr. Paul Tripp says emotions are like flashing lights on the dashboard of your car, alerting you that something is happening with your engine. That is your heart. Dr. Susan David says emotions are data, not directives. They are signals calling for your attention. And she asks, do you know how to read and interpret this data? Hillary McBride says emotions are powerful, essentially bodily processes. They are the energy that moves through our bodies that help us to feel safe. She adds, when we know how to notice that energy and make meaning of it and manage it, our emotions help us be fully alive. Okay, and I like that, because she's saying our emotions, that's what moves you as men. Emotions. That's what moves you. EQ self means you're attentive to what moves you. And you've learned to ask yourself, where's this energy coming from? Where's this energy coming from? And it's disorienting, because we're compelled to acknowledge some things about ourselves that we don't like. Well, Robert Downey Jr. once called hugging the cactus. When we look under our emotions, we're compelled to acknowledge that our real God, that which our heart truly loves, may not be the God we profess. And this is a startling realization for most men, as it was for me. Idols are emotional attachments. They're emotional attachments. That's why you can't uproot an idol with information alone, even after it's been identified. Why is that? Why is there such a different distance between my head and my heart? Because your wounds are deeper than your convictions. I'm learning when I sense a part of me feeling anxious to detect that as a signal, like a flashing yellow light. Pay attention. Pay attention. Something you care about requires attention. Now, how's your EQ self? Are you aware of your patterns and your scripts? How you deal with your so-called distressing emotions? Takes a long time to believe what Mr. Rogers tried to tell us as children. Anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that's mentionable can be more manageable. When we can talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming. You know, Mr. Rogers said that to kids, but might be more applicable to a room full of men. The other part of EQ self is self-management. How well are you able to manage your emotions once you've identified them? You're not only able to name, but engage, regulate, and respond in keeping with your professed values. Lisa D'Amore comments, "Mental health is not about feeling good. It's about having the right feelings at the right time and being able to manage those emotions effectively." It's about having the right feelings at the right time and being able to manage those emotions effectively. Some of us have children with mental health challenges. There's a delicate continuum here. They did not choose this malady. But if we sever a connection to any responsibility, we might be demolishing a bridge that we all need to cross for our own healing, and that is learning to take responsibility. It's not about feeling good. It's about having the right feelings at the right time and being able to manage those emotions effectively. For those of us who are fathers, have you trained your children in this skill? Having the right feelings at the right time and being able to manage those emotions effectively. I mean, if we can't do that, how can we train our children to become fluent in a language they've never heard Dad speak? And I'm not blaming us. I'm encouraging you, if you're a dad, to take the lead and invite your children into a journey of generational healing. This is not newfangled. 2,400 years ago, Aristotle said anyone can become angry. That's easy. But to be angry with the right person to the right degree at the right time for the right purpose in the right way, this is not easy. And it's still not easy. Ecclesiastes says there's a time for everything, and a phrase that arrested me when I dwelled upon it was a time to weep and a time to laugh. It's my second time visiting here. I'll comment as a stranger at the risk of never being invited back. I notice a lot of laughter in this room. I wonder what that's about. A time to weep and a time to laugh. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, sorrowful yet always rejoicing. I don't know about you, but I didn't know how to do that. I had no idea what that meant. Had no idea how to grieve. I told myself I did. I was an ICU trauma chaplain. I thought I was poised. Turns out I did not have the right feelings at the right time. I was not able to manage my emotions effectively. Would have been far healthier if I had allowed myself to grieve. And I've learned that's a marker of emotional health, your ability to accept and tell your own story without shame. Another marker of emotional health in yourself is you can sit and stay engaged with others in their pain. You can listen attentively without feeling a need to solve or offer advice. You're in touch with your own pain, so you can sit with others in theirs. You know what that means? It means you're slow to speak. It means, in the Bible's word, you weep with those who weep. Self-management takes a lot of training because you're breaking habitual patterns, long-term coping mechanisms that you've used for decades. These emotion control strategies you've employed from before you can remember to soothe yourself. You can't uproot these overnight. You can't think your way out of a problem you didn't think your way into. Let me close with this, because the clock tells me my time is up. Jesus once asked a man, do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed? And I want to tell you, don't assume that you do. Because a lot of us prefer the hell we know. Do you want to be healed? Don't beat yourself up. Shame is not going to help you. Remember, Jesus' love for you is not conditioned by your health. It's not the healthy who need a doctor, Jesus said. Close with a quick story. A monk from the Brother Monastery to the Sisters of Charity in Calcutta came to Mother Teresa and said, Mother, my life's a mess. I don't get to do what I'm called to do. My superior in the order gives me a hard time, and the government makes me do all this paperwork. I just don't get to do what I'm called to do. Mother Teresa said, Brother, what is your calling? He said, well, my calling is to care for the poor. She said, oh, no. Your calling is not to care for the poor. Your calling is to know how much Jesus loves you and then to love others in the overflow of that love. That's all we're talking about here this morning, is grasping how high and wide and deep is the love of God for you, grasping that in your heart, so that we are finally set free to love the people that we love and others. Hey, thanks for having me.